I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's good to be back, Michael.
We are taking on suitably somber tones this morning as we address Gaza, Palestine and Israel, Israel and Palestine, something that's been an active issue since 1948 when the State of Israel was created. It was sort of prefaced by the Balfour Declaration going back to the 1920s, 100 years ago. And of course, Jews around the world, particularly after the Holocaust, were looking for a homeland. But the Palestinians, of course, also called and call the areas home. During the last week, there was a telling piece of news analysis by Roger Cohen, reporting from Jerusalem in the New York Times. And I'll just set up our discussion today by reading from the first part of his article. 8 years after the foundation of the State of Israel, Moshe Dayan, the chief of staff of the Israeli military, stood close to the Gaza border to pronounce a eulogy for a 21-year-old Israeli security officer slain by Palestinian and Egyptian assailants. Quote, "Let us not today cast blame on his murderers," he said in 1956. "What can we say against their terrible hatred of us? For 8 years now, they have sat in the refugee camps of Gaza and have watched how, before their very eyes, we have turned their land and villages, where they and their forefathers previously dwelled, into our home." Cohen goes on, his short speech, a little longer than the Lincoln's Gettysburg address, and a powerful reference for Israelis, is perhaps recalled less for this insight into Palestinian anger than for Mr. Dayan's resolute conclusion. And I quote, "Without the steel helmet and the cannons more, we will not be able to plant a tree and build a home." Cohen suggests that nothing has really changed, although the Palestinian anger references are not often recalled in the heat of battle today. Martin, a lot of serious questions. There's a lot of commentary. We as human beings, citizens in a sense of the world and of our own country, try to understand what is happening and what has happened and what can possibly be done to resolve the conflict involving Israel and Palestine. But I've made some brief references to how Gaza came to be Gaza, but tell our listeners a little bit about the background to how Israel came to be and the creation of this conflict.
Yeah, it's a long and complex story. In some ways, you couldn't do it justice in a short period of time. But as you've indicated, the Israeli state was set up post-World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust, and in recognition of the fact that Jewish people had been persecuted for centuries and had never been afforded their own real home. And this was certainly Jerusalem and Israel was certainly a place that they claimed as an ancestral homeland. It was, of course, already like the in 1788 when the Europeans came, when the British came here, was completely occupied already. I should say there were Israelis living there from the late 19th century onwards, as well as Palestinians, but they're certainly outnumbered. And this was a thriving community for decades before that state was created. It was, ever since then, there's been ongoing conflict, sometimes more pronounced than others, and there have been periods of peace, but mostly interludes within hostilities. I think some people would be most aware of the accords struck under Clinton between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, which, a bit like the Northern Ireland situation, looked like the light at the end of a tunnel. And I think there was some real hope that was present at the time. Of course, we know what happened to Yitzhak Rabin. And there was a change in government and in Israel, also some developments in the Palestinian leadership as well. So I think we might come to the political and military leadership at some stage, Michael, in this discussion, because I think they deserve a lot of the blame. And things have gone downhill and down south since. Most pundits talk about a two-state solution. You'll hear that bandied a lot. The difficulty there is they would roughly use the pre-1967 boundaries as a reference point, and a lot has changed since 1967. In particular, many, many Israeli settlements in the West Bank would make this extremely difficult now, because a lot of the contested land has been settled by settlers. And let's face it, they're ultra-nationalists who see their right to that land as some God-given ancestral right, and that has inflamed situations enormously and made a peace settlement extremely difficult. And I think we're further away from peace than we've been, than ever been before, and that's the really distressing point. It goes to that original quote, which I think is a really powerful one. It's a reminder that real security is only ever delivered through peace. And this has been the mindset of the current Israeli government, has been that they could deliver peace through exclusion, through a giant wall and a whole heap of, you know, a military defense system and a whole heap of other security measures. And look, history has told us otherwise, that only peace processes actually bring about security. But that's a really short potted history, but it doesn't speak to the many nuances in between.
You mentioned the governance issues within the Palestinian territory. We've got the Palestinian Authority and we've got Hamas. Hamas plainly has the guns and is prepared to use them, or has been. And with the gun comes, I suppose, political control. You read in the media at the moment that there are efforts, particularly from the US side, I believe, to try and re-promote the Palestinian Authority's authority. What's the background to some of that, and why isn't there one strong Palestinian government there to press the case for all Palestinians?
Yeah, look, there's never been one united entity anyway. I think that's a myth, but for a long time, the Palestinian Liberation Authority, which is a predecessor of the Palestinian Authority, had some kind of, you know, symbolic or representative clout. They themselves were engaged in military actions and activities and resistance actions and many activities that people would consider dubious, but this is a long-running and dubious conflict anyway. And Yasser Arafat was their national leader. His death really splintered things, and the peace process in itself didn't have universal acceptance. His successor, Mahmoud Abbas, was seen in some quarters as too weak or too indecisive, but was also accused of corruption as well. So there's a lot of different myriads of layers there. And all the while, many ordinary Palestinians live lives in misery, really, in great depths of disadvantage. So it's natural that they would be cynical sometimes about leadership along the way. And the problem with violence and conflict and poverty and disadvantage is, of course, it breeds extremism. It allows those tendencies to really thrive. I will take an aim at Hamas. Don't worry, I'm not going to let Israeli government off the hook either, Michael. But Hamas is a proscribed terrorist organisation. Their atrocities on 7th of October were awful. They knew that they were throwing their own people under the bus when they did it. Most of their leaders live in luxury in Qatar and other places. So they are absolutely part of the problem. And I said I'd take aim at the Israeli government as well. Israeli government, since Netanyahu took over, and he's been there for decades, he's not any Johnny come lately, has made no significant progress towards peace or demonstrated any willingness or interest in the peace process. They've simply sought to guarantee peace through exclusion and through violence and other means. They've allowed this settler movement to proliferate and made peace all but impossible in many ways there. And they're responding with extreme violence. And Israel is because it's an asymmetric conflict, which is a fancy way of saying one group's far more powerful than the other, the group that's more powerful has extra responsibility to demonstrate restraint. And that's not being, it's clearly not evident at the moment in the Gaza Strip. So they've got a lot to answer for. I think the Israelis, you know, it's not for me to tell Israelis who to elect, but it's unfathomable that that he keeps on getting elected to government and has made no attempt to resolve this longstanding issue that affects Israeli civilians and Palestinian civilians alike. So there's been a lot of issues with the way their own leaders have conducted themselves on both sides. And in between all of this is the humanity, the awful predicament that particularly Palestinians, but we saw on October the 7th, Israeli civilians are not immune from this either, find themselves in, pawns in a bigger struggle.
The piece by Roger Cohen, from which I've quoted, is headed that in a conflict marked by complete incomprehension on both sides, the ability to see each other as human has been lost. And that's the thing, of course, that distresses so many of us. It distresses me, this apparent inability to see each other as humans any longer. The necessity to defend the state created in 1948 in Israel prevents the Israeli side from doing that, and ditto Hamas and its supporters stuck in a past, perhaps still 1948, wanting to reclaim territory, and perhaps a politically unreality to that, are incapable of seeing the Israelis, particularly the people in the kibbutzim who were just, as you said, so awfully murdered and tortured, and some of whom are still being held. What remind our readers, did the Oslo Accord suggest was the way forward? And you've pointed out that a lot's happened in the West Bank when it comes to looking at a two-state solution. And are there any proposals apart from the two-state solution currently on the table?
I think, in short, no good ones. On the, how about we say none that really present a realistic prospect at this stage? So what would be the end game of all of this? And that's where Israel's attack on Gaza, like, what is the end game there? Because I can guarantee there'll be another generation, yet another generation of young Palestinians who will be grow up with a, you know, extreme hatred of people that would inflict such violence on them. So that's certainly not going to help. But where's the solutions? There's been some suggestion that the Palestinian Authority could govern Gaza. That's an extremely difficult proposition, especially if they're seen in, as colluding in any way, shape or form with the Israelis and doing so. I can't see that being viable. There's other suggestions that somehow other Arab states could come in and act as some kind of peacekeeping entity. Perhaps that's a least worst prospect than other ones, but you know they will still be conflict, and you know I suspect if I'm in a foreign government like that, whether it's Qatari or elsewhere, and they seem to be a bit of a broker with the current truce that's well, we hope gets up. You know, I wouldn't be stepping in. I think that you'd be stepping straight into a no-win situation, like an awful predicament, because you wouldn't want to really be seen with colluding with the Israelis either if you're trying to govern in some peacekeeping way the Gaza Strip. So I'd be, you know, I can't see too many individual governments willing to weigh in directly into a conflict like this. So there's no obvious political solution at the moment, Michael. I think that the predicament of the Palestinian people is getting so bad that the calls for a ceasefire are growing, a longer ceasefire. And sooner or later, I think that's going to be, those calls will be too loud to be ignored. But still, that doesn't solve the longer-term problem that we have.
I, at my current age of 73 this year, Martin, think about my 19-year-old eldest granddaughter. And I wonder when she's approaching my age in about 50 years' time, whether there will have been any change in this conflict. I mean, it's impossible to see some flicker of light at the end of any tunnel at all from where I sit at the moment. Do you have to place your trust in the goodness of human nature at the end of the day breaking through, or are there other positive signs you can point to now as to a solution eventually?
I'm pretty pessimistic at the moment. It's hard to be too optimistic right now. And the truth that we're seeing, you know, unfold, if it does unfold, is only for both sides to get a bit of what they want, for Israel to get some of their citizens back that were held hostage, and for Hamas to get a short pause so they can perhaps regroup or, strategize. I'm not sure. But both sides want to get something out of this pause, and that's the only reason why they're doing it. I don't think there's the sadness here, and you referred to this earlier, is they're not really pausing out of their concern for the humanity and the people that whose violence they're inflicting on. I don't think. That's the cynical part of me. I think that they still are concerned about getting what they want, and that's an awful predicament for the people, the innocent people that particularly in Gaza at the moment. I mean, it's interesting. No one will really know what the full political opinion of people in Gaza is, because they haven't had an election in 17 years, Michael. And, it's not like we can run easily opinion polls there, but they would be entitled to be utterly disillusioned. Both, obviously, you kind of blame them for being extremely bitter at the Israeli Defense Forces for the violence inflicted on them. And they're probably live in fear of Hamas as well. So it's just an awful place to be. And where can they go? They can't even, in a lot of conflicts, you can have refugees. There's outlets for people, even in Iraq, the awful conflict there, millions, and Syria, millions of people went over the border and were in refugee camps. The people of Gaza can't even get out at the moment.
Even the ones who went south have still been bombed by bombs and guns. You hear about the two-state solution, and you've pointed some difficulties with that. When first promoted, it would have taken in a good part of the West Bank. The Israeli settlers have moved in, and they just described them as ultra-nationalists. They appear to be part of the significant political problem in trying to resolve the issues. I mean, is there a one-state solution? Can you actually accord Palestinian people full citizenship rights and run the nation as one place? I suppose the difficulty that some of my Jewish friends have pointed out in the past is that the numbers game will then take hold, and perhaps the Palestinians will outvote the non-Palestinian Israeli citizenry. But is a one-state solution viable instead of having an Israel which is effectively surrounded by a Palestinian state?
It is completely unviable at the moment. I mean, I'm with you in that a one-state solution would be lovely, because the problem with two-state solution is in effect you're creating these states based on ethnic groups, and every area has minority groups in it. I mean, Israel has plenty of Arabs living in Israel, and Palestine has all sorts of other minorities, and Orthodox Christians and Catholics and people of all different minority ethnic groups, etc. And when you try to create a whole state based on one ethnic group, you've got problems, because what are the rights of minorities there? So, I mean, in theory, a one-state solution where everyone has equal rights is by far the best, but I think that would never be accepted by Israel in particular, because they would be outnumbered pretty quickly. And also, I think that at the moment, the extreme hatred and bitterness that exists after these decades and decades of conflict make that solution unviable as well. I think there needs to be a period of where people learn to get along with each other. You've seen gradually over time in Northern Ireland where people, you know, people go about their economic business and their lives, and their, and hopefully those sectarian battles that underpin that conflict slowly, you know, ebb. I mean, I don't think that's even happened in Northern Ireland yet, several decades later, but and maybe it takes 50 or more years, but ultimately that's a better solution than perhaps a one-state solution right now, because I just can't see either side really accepting that it would work.
Martin, about the same time that the State of Israel was created, the United Nations came into being. We'd had a League of Nations before it. We put a lot of hope in the United Nations. We have a Security Council. Big countries have, powerful countries have vetoes and the like. And so it often leads to people just going directly to those big, powerful countries to see whether they might all agree on something. And, you know, in a very quick way, taking into account, broadly speaking, the EU, you really turn to the United States, Russia still, and increasingly China. Is there some way, do you think, that those powerful nations can force, can effect, can create the circumstances that bring the human situation to the fore and forces a resolution?
I think that, you know, I certainly find that idea very attractive and would be good. There's another backdrop to this that's not always fully understood, and that's that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has always been a conduit for other people's agendas. And clearly, the US and Iran have been loggerheads for decades, and Iran supports Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and US supports Israel. And that's part of the problem too. Russia and China, that you might have thought might have provided some kind of peacemaker opportunities here, are both in different ways at loggerheads with the US, particularly Russia, so much so that Russia would love nothing more than perhaps using it as an opportunity. US is fairly compromised in this area because of its really close alliance with Israel. It can't really act as an independent broker anyway. It's seen as far too close to Israel and dismissive of Palestinian cause. So, you know, you can't see an obvious pathway either for the international community in resolving this very easily.
Martin, the State of Israel and its continued existence is born on the understanding, with any negotiations happening, there's a recognition by the Palestinians or any of the other actors in that region that Israel has a right to exist, and that has to be a given. Is it a given today, or do we simply take the backdrop you've just described as a lack of acceptance of that US resolution?
I think it's a given in one sense, in that obviously that's not the view held by Hamas and a number of other Palestinian militant groups, but I don't think beyond that people are actually talking about this dismantling of the Israeli state. However, there needs to be an agreement, a long-standing agreement, that takes into consideration Palestinian claims and grievances in a really substantive way, not just in a half-hearted way, for them to accept that. So that's got to be part of the ultimate solution. You know, if Israel were really genuinely prepared to make peace, they'd actually dismantle quite a few of those settlements in the West Bank, in areas that the Palestinians see as very much as part of any Palestinian state. If you actually look at where they've settled, it makes a Palestinian state very much unviable, because it's right across the heartland of the West Bank. It'd be very difficult to have a state that didn't have those settlements in it. And I think that's been allowed to continue deliberately to undermine the prospect of a Palestinian state. And if that's the case, how can you actually have lasting peace, knowing that that's at the center of the other side's claims? So, yeah, that's part of the process that makes me pretty pessimistic at this stage about a peace settlement. But yeah, one thing we can't forget amongst all of this is the particular people and families that are caught up in this, whose you know you know, we had everyone, you're seeing all these stories about entire families that are ripped apart through what's happening in Gaza at the moment. So, and of course, what happened in Israel on October the 7th.
It is one of the most challenging things, and the things we can't predict. And there's a lot of commentary in the international and national press on this topic, whether Netanyahu can actually survive. The simple analysis is he's kept in power because he's kept moving to the right. He's got the settlers supporting him. If that political equation were to change and Netanyahu weren't there and the politics were more in the centre, and the people, the Jews in Israel, who are trying to combine with the Arabs and the Palestinians to create a national conversation more conducive to peace, were to be achieved, I suppose we could become more optimistic that something could be discussed and worked out.
I think so. I mean, your best prospects in a fairly gloomy situation would be the removal of the Netanyahu government and its replacement with a more centrist government. And because something you've alluded to a couple of times that I didn't fully explain is that his government's effectively propped up through a coalition of far-right Israeli nationalists. So, you know, in some ways, that ties his hands, for even if he were, and I'm not convinced, prepared to make peace in a substantive way, his hands are somewhat tied for that reason as well. So I think that would make a big difference. And of course, it would have to be mirrored on the Palestinian side by, and I don't know, some form of leadership prepared to make peace as well. That is credible. And that's the thing. The leadership on both sides is not all that credible at the moment. I mean, we haven't even discussed how Netanyahu's government has spent a considerable period of time trying to nobble the judiciary and make sure that it can stack it with whoever it likes, and prevent criticism of government. So there's a lot of problems in the way that both entities are being governed at the moment.
Martin, we have to bring this conversation to an end. People are talking incessantly and we could keep talking at length. We will watch the party with our hearts and our mouths as this conflict continues. We hope that the pause, not even a ceasefire, has some useful results, and that more of the hostages can be released and the circumstances for discussion can continue. But it does look like we're going to see an Israeli Defence Force occupation, however you want to call it, of Gaza for some time to come. Do you think that's inevitable?
Of sorts, in a kind of way. I don't know what the end game here for the Israeli Defence Forces is, because if you try and occupy Gaza, you are making yourself a sitting target all the time. And the US found this in Iraq and other places. The population there will hate them. They will be targets. They know it's not a political solution. It will drain incredible resources. There'll be Israeli citizens, because they are forced into service, Michael, unless they've got exemptions. They'll come back in body bags. I mean, it's not going to be it would not be a pleasant occupation. Obviously, and I haven't even started talking about its impact on Palestinians yet. I think it's untenable over a longer period of time. So even in their sense, they would have to come up with a better prospect than that.
Martin, I want to thank you, both myself and on behalf of our listeners who have had the benefit of your observations today. We hope, without stirring the pots that we don't want to stir, that our discussion has been respectful and thoughtful and has assisted people to process what's happening here, and we'll come back to it at some point.
Probably the one last thing to say, Michael, yes, if you don't mind, is I entirely understand why people have very passionate views about this, but please don't bring anti-Semitism or Islamophobia back into conversations here, because I think that just makes things so much worse.
You're right. Thanks, Martin. We'll catch up again soon.
Thank you.